It's the Burt Cohen Show. Very unusual history is being made now in Washington, D.C. Things are really, really screwy. As this is being recorded, we're still in shutdown. The very far right, the extreme right, is trying to do something really, really different. And our guest today is investigative reporter Robert Perry, who is suggesting that this may be the white man's last tantrum, the white man's last tantrum. We'll look into that. Robert, thank you for being with us. Robert is an investigative reporter who broke many of the Iran-Contra stories for the Associated Press and Newsweek in the 1980s. And his new book is America's Stolen Narrative. It's either in print or as an ebook from Amazon and Barnes & Noble. Bob, thanks for being with us yet again on the Burt Cohen Show.
Thank you, Burt.
Well, I got to read a quote I read from this morning's paper. This is from Andrew Sullivan. He says, and I think this really fits, quote, "There is effectively no Republican Party anymore. There is a radical movement to destroy the modern American state and to eviscerate its institutions in favor of restoring a mythical Elysian majority white 19th century past," which is exactly what we're talking about. "This crisis is proving that more powerfully than even watching Fox News. We need to see what is in front of our nose. A cold civil war has broken out between those properly called conservatives defending the credit of the government, empirical reality, and adjustments to modern life, and those properly called radical reactionaries declaring our current elected president and Senate as illegitimate actors, bent on the destruction of America and therefore necessitating total political warfare, even to the point of threatening to destroy the global economy," end quote from Andrew Sullivan. And this fits in, the hopefully, the last white man's tantrum. The Tea Party represents clearly an enraged class of usually white men that feel like they're seeing society change in ways they don't like. Many feel entitled to rule, as they did after the so-called Civil War ended their privileged positions. Robert Perry, again, after reading your article at consortium.org, is it fair to conclude that you say the issue is not any policy concessions that the right wing may extract from the government, that the essence of this historically new struggle is over something rather old historically, and that is white Protestant male domination and control? Is that what this is really about? Could it be that simple?
Well, I'm not sure it's that simple, Bert. By the way, it's consortiumnews.com. I'm afraid.
Oh, sorry.
People go to .org is something totally different. But yeah, I think what we're seeing here, and I have to tend to agree with Sullivan's article, that this is an effort to maintain this old-fashioned control of the U.S. political system that we've seen really since the 19th century, with first slavery and the efforts to maintain that through the first half of that century. Then, of course, the Civil War finally put an end to slavery, but after a brief effort for Reconstruction that would have required the white Southerners to accept blacks as their equals, the white Southerners were able, through a variety of means, some violent, some political, some economic, to force an acceptance by the North of essentially a reconstituted system of white supremacy and control of the South.
Yep.
That continued in a de jure fashion until the 1960s, when the civil rights movement was able to break that hold. And that's a very key moment, because if you get to the when you get to the 1960s and the decision of the Democratic Party, which the Democratic Party had traditionally been the party of slavery and then segregation.
Yep. Oh yeah.
That was why the so-called Solid South voted Democrat all the time, because the Republicans, in their formation in the late 1850s, was an anti-slavery party, mm-hmm. and the election of Abraham Lincoln as the first Republican president was what precipitated the Southern secession and the Civil War. So, but when you get to the 1960s, the Democrats switched under the leadership of President Kennedy and then President Johnson, and with the great social and political pressure created by Martin Luther King Jr. and the Civil Rights Movement, the Democratic Party embraced civil rights. At that point, opportunistic Republicans, particularly Richard Nixon and then later Ronald Reagan, saw an opportunity to snatch away the Southern states, put them in the Republican column, and they did so with what Nixon called the Southern strategy, which was making more subtle allusions to the race issue. Reagan did the same. Reagan basically consolidated that control with his appeals about welfare queens, and they both talked about the importance of states' rights. These were all code words that white Southerners, the people that were angry about integration, fully understood. And that and the impetus that came out of that backlash, that white backlash, propelled the Republican Party to dominance at the national level for a number of years. And only recently have the demographics and generally the cultural changes in America begun to erode that and made it much harder for Republicans to win national elections. So what we're seeing now is a new phase of that. The Republicans, essentially in the right wing, understand that because of the demographic changes in America and the fact that many younger whites no longer share these racial prejudices that were historic in America, that because of that, they don't have the numbers anymore. They cannot gin up the numbers to prevail in national elections. So they've gone to a whole series of anti-democratic procedures, whether it be trying to suppress the vote through voter ID rules or by cutting back voting hours. They've also aggressively gerrymandered districts when they control various states, when the Republicans control these states, to lump all the Democratic votes in one district so they can make sure the other districts are reliably Republican. So even though they lost not just the vote for president in 2012, but they lost the vote for the House of Representatives by about 1.5 million votes. So, but it was only because they had engaged in these various subterfuges that they were able to maintain their, quote, majority, unquote, in the House. So what they've had to do, if they're going to actually continue to maintain control, they need new tactics.
Right.
And the new tactic we're now seeing playing out. They've got to essentially hold the U.S. government and the U.S. economy and to arguably the world economy hostage and threaten to kill the hostage if they are not given the policies they want, whether it be the repeal of Obamacare or opening up the Keystone Pipeline, or they've got a whole list of these, their whole wish list now is being presented, and they've been saying, if we don't get these policies, even though we lost the elections fair and square,
right,
and we only maintained our foothold through essentially cheating, we now want all these policy prescriptions passed, accepted. And if we don't get our way, we're going to take the country down.
Take the whole thing.
So that is a dramatically new and very important change in how they've approached it. It's essentially a new constitutional structure that they have developed, which sort of maximizes the value of white votes, and particularly right-wing white votes, and minimizes and essentially negates the value of votes from minorities and young whites who don't share this sort of hatred of government that that many on the right do.
Yeah, and it's so fascinating to see how, as the old saying goes, the more things change, the more they stay the same. After, and you obviously know history quite well, one thing I always appreciate about talking with you, Robert Perry, is that, you know, after the war against Southern independence, that there was Reconstruction, as you mentioned, tried to force equality on the white people on there. But then right after that fell apart, there was the redemption movement in the South, which was about redeeming the seemingly entitled place of white working people over blacks. And it was a very, very powerful movement that, as you mentioned, continued really into the 1960s. And now we're seeing, because of obviously demographic changes, I mean, these are realistic changes, they can't stand it. And so they're kind of throwing a fit, throwing a tantrum. And we're used to, you know, if you've watched the news for the past 20 years or so, terrorists take hostages and they have a list of demands before they'll free the hostage. They're not threatening actual violence, but there's this, as you mentioned, list of demands where if you don't meet them, you know, they'll kill the hostage. And it's really clearly like that. And I just, it is rather amazing that since it does look like, as you mentioned, the title of your article on consortiumnews.com, the white man's last tantrum. I don't know if it's going to be the last tantrum, but it does kind of look like a tantrum since they lost the game over and over and over again. The Affordable Care Act was voted in 43 times, I believe it is. They kept losing. So now they're just stamping their feet, taking the ball and running away and saying nobody is playing with it. Now, it's been brought up that the Tea Party isn't all white males from the South, that there may even be some black people, some minority people involved. Certainly there are women involved. Is it fair to equate or draw a comparison of the Tea Party with the, you know, infamous white racists of the 1950s? What's your take on that, Robert?
Well, I think it is fair. I'm not saying it's entirely... You can't say that they embrace everything that was embraced very explicitly in the 1950s, but that is pretty much where they're headed. They people are now smart enough to use code words for what they used to perhaps be more blunt about, and that's something that Nixon pioneered in the 1960s when he'd be smart enough to talk about welfare cheats, right, or states' rights, and now, of course, the new code word is small government, meaning the small federal government, and really this all goes back, if you follow it historically, back to that period, even to the 1790s, when the plantation structure of the South saw the new Constitution, which consolidated power at the federal level, took it away from the states.
Mm-hmm.
The states under the Articles of Confederation were considered independent and sovereign.
Right.
The federal government was not even a government; it was called the League of Friendship, and that system was failing. That's why in 1787, George Washington, James Madison, who was then one of Washington's proteges, Alexander Hamilton, Gouverneur Morris, and others got together in Philadelphia, in secret, to essentially redo the whole system and to consolidate power in the federal government. They stripped out the language about sovereign and independent states. They made the sovereignty implicitly the we the people of the United States, and they were very clear about this. And so were the opponents, the so-called anti-federalists at the time, some of whom walked out of the convention. Explained what was happening, and they were quite clear that this was an assault on states' rights, and that was what the fight against the Constitution was in 1788, the idea that the federal government was being made so powerful by this new document that it would negate the authority of the states. Now, it was narrowly ratified. People should remember that. It was a pretty tough fight. And in places like Virginia, the argument was made by people like Patrick Henry and George Mason that the consolidating of so much power in the federal government would ultimately lead to the abolition of slavery. Their concern, and the concern of many in the South, was that their vast investment in slaves would become worthless. But the Constitution was narrowly ratified, and that's how it was. But the whole idea of building a strong and effective federal government was what the so-called Federalists were all about in the 1790s. However, the anti-Federalists did not go away.
Right.
They organized themselves largely behind a charismatic political figure, Thomas Jefferson, to sort of essentially reinterpret what people understood the Constitution to be at the beginning, and trying to narrow it down, reinstitute the idea of states' rights as an important element, even though it's not in the document itself. That was the struggle that we saw play out very bitterly in the 1790s. And then in the early part of the 19th century, you see the success of that movement and the consolidation of slavery. And Jefferson played a very big role in that, partly through the Louisiana territories that he purchased from France, that opened up vast new areas for slavery. And that increased the value of slaves, because after the Constitution forbade the continued importation of slaves, that meant that the slaves already in the United States could be bred and sold at a high price. In effect, the slave owners saw the value of their commodity increase dramatically. So what we saw really in that period was this effort to maintain an economic system in the South. And ultimately, ironically, the premonition of Patrick Henry and George Mason turned out to be true, that as the North became more and more powerful, as the industrialization spread, the abolitionist movement became stronger, and ultimately it did, through the Civil War, bring about the end of slavery. But what you're seeing, what you've been seeing, is this assertion of white supremacy.
Yes.
Whether it be direct, as in the case of the slavery era, slightly more subtle, but not much, during the era of segregation and Jim Crow, and then a little more subtle still after the Civil Rights Movement. You couldn't quite say the same stuff and be taken seriously, so you had to sort of phrase it differently. And we saw Ronald Reagan talking about the welfare queens who were buying vodka with their food stamps. And everyone got the message. Everyone got the picture.
No, it was pretty clear.
But it wasn't done with quite the crudeness that you would have seen in during the slave period or the segregation period. But it was still kind of the same points. We have to suppress the power of the federal government. We have to establish states' rights. We have to let them take actions that are harsh against their minority citizens. We have to let them take steps to make it harder for black people and Hispanic people to vote. All these things, they're not that much different from what we were seeing earlier. It's just that the phrasing is now done as, oh, we need to protect the sanctity of the ballot. We have to prevent voter fraud.
Right.
But everyone kind of gets it, that what we're really talking about is enhancing the value of a white vote versus a black vote.
It's amazing how it just goes on from the founding of this country to today. And certainly, I think it could be said that George Corley Wallace, who was a candidate for president, pretty openly racist at the time in 1968, and then he was shot in 1972, that Nixon very intelligently, wisely, cleverly co-opted that movement, that whole white racist movement. And to see it really now, but just phrased slightly differently, it's still really there. I got to ask Robert Perry, what would you say to African-American members of the Tea Party who would say, no, no, this is wrong. It's not about racism at all. What would, I mean, and there are some people like that. What would you say to them? Are they just being manipulated?
Well, I don't think there are a lot of,
no, not
of
very many
African-Americans in the Tea Party movement. I mean, I'm sure there are some, and there, I'm sure there are some now black Republicans.
Yeah.
As I said, you know, for a long time, the Republican Party was the party of civil rights.
And, absolutely.
And you had even people like Branch Rickey and other people who fought for integration were Republicans. So you had that history of, you know, Jackie Robinson was a Republican.
Branch Rickey's
so you had
person.
You had that history, and so it does get a little bit muddled, but
sure.
It is. But essentially, what you've seen is a dramatic switch when the Republicans began to pander to the white racists when they tried to bring in the Wallace people, as you put it, into the Republican Party, and they did so very successfully. You saw the African American population become heavily Democratic. They switched sides too, and they went with the Democratic Party. So, so yes, you can find black Republicans. You can find, I'm sure, you can find a black Tea Party member or two, but there really aren't that many.
No.
And some of them, I'm not quite sure. You have to probably ask them exactly what if they're troubled by some of the messages that they're hearing. If they're troubled by this idea that President Obama must have been born in Kenya or some or whatever.
Yeah, to delegitimize him.
Effort to delegitimize the first African-American president. Maybe they don't mind. I don't know. But I mean, but it certainly is. It's hard to say that the Tea Party and the way it's behaved with the kind of tone of its rallies, the hostility toward anything that is beneficial to the black population in a broad way, that's what the Tea Party has come to stand for. They're very much in support of these efforts to restrain the black vote, to cut back on voting hours, to require tighter rules about voting, knowing that many black people, and especially urban blacks, do not have driver's licenses. They don't drive.
Of course.
They don't have cars, many of them, because they rely on mass transit. So it makes it harder relative in terms of numbers for them to get the IDs that many suburban white people they expect to have and obviously do have in greater numbers and greater proportions.
Yeah, it's like the, I'm reminded of the old poll tax. Well, what could be wrong with requiring, you know, reading test, you know, literacy test? There used to be literacy tests. You know, you could argue that you should be literate to be able to vote, but the reality was that an awful lot of blacks who were quite able to participate and full citizens had not had the education to read, and those tests could be rigged, to put it mildly. And the point was to keep blacks from being able to participate. There's once again the sense that there's, you know, an entitlement to white men, and now they're throwing this amazing tantrum right now that we're seeing here, which is the article we're discussing with our guest, Robert Perry. The article is in consortiumnews.com. And this intransigence, this hostage-taking, really, this absolute refusal to compromise. You know, we've seen that throughout the Obama presidency. Normally, it seems to me, you know, say if you have a different opinion, that, you know, once an election is held, then kind of the politics ends and the government starts. And normally, you know, if Republicans lost or Democrats lost, they'd recognize, okay, this guy, so far, is the president, and it's our responsibility to govern. We haven't seen that from these guys. How much of this is new tactics, this holding America hostage by the Tea Party right? These are really new tactics, are they not? You have a great knowledge of history. Have we seen actions like this before, or is this really pretty new?
Well, we saw actions like this in the years before the Civil War. We saw at that point the South was so afraid that ultimately the federal government would decide to eradicate slavery that Southerners began to fight every effort for the federal government to do anything, including things like disaster relief. You saw in the period of the 1850s, Southern legislators opposing disaster relief because the thinking was, well, if the federal government can come in and help people who've suffered from a flood, what will stop them from coming in and freeing the slaves? So there was that sort of thinking that was going on at that time. But we really haven't, it's been rare to have this kind of obstructionism, especially when the one party does not have a mandate. As I say, they Right. only carried the House of Representatives after they lost the popular vote for the House of Representatives. And that's because the system had been rigged through very sophisticated gerrymandering. This isn't the old kind of gerrymandering where some pile thinks, well, if we throw this town in with that town, we'll be able to tilt the voting this way or that way. This was a case of using computers and carefully assessing voting patterns to lump some districts together to make it harder to put all Democrats together in one district so they could free up comfortable majorities for Republicans in other districts. In the case of Ohio, for instance, the Republican State House took a district based in Cleveland that Dennis Kucinich had represented, mm-hmm. and put it together with a district in Toledo that Marcy Kaptur had represented. And the trouble is that these cities are 116 miles apart. Mm. They then did a little narrow strip along Lake Erie, so narrow that you have to go outside the district to drive from Cleveland to Toledo. And then they pitted these two Democrats against each other. Kaptur won the primary. Kucinich was kicked out of Congress.
Right.
But the point of doing that was to figure out how you can then create safe Republican districts elsewhere around Ohio, and so in other words, there's no popular mandate for the Republican Party at this point. They say, well, we still have the majority in the House, but they only have that because they were able to overcome the majority vote for the Democrats. So, but they don't seem to even care at this point that they don't have a mandate. They're acting like, and that gets to the whole idea of white supremacy. What gives these people the idea that they should be able to just overrule various elections in which this more diverse America expressed its desires to do certain things, including electing President Obama, continuing the Democratic control of the Senate, giving the Democrats a majority of votes for the House. So what is going on here? Because usually you'd say to yourself, well, I may disagree with someone, but they won the election. They have a mandate to govern.
Exactly.
And you would give that, and you would not, and you would, you might still argue for your point of view.
Right.
And you're not going to just give up on your point of view, but you would accept that the elections have consequences. And you would work to the next election to do better and get your guys elected or your gals elected. But here, the point is, well, that election doesn't matter because many of the votes for Obama and for the Democrats came from blacks, Hispanics, Asian Americans, essentially non-whites.
And young people. And young white people.
And young white Americans who are not as hung up on race
right.
as some of the older folks are.
It's really amazing to see. I mean, you get a picture of, you know, a constitutional system that has had difficulties, but has worked pretty well for a couple hundred years. And now we have people who claim the mantle of one of the two legitimate parties, and they're trying to throw a monkey wrench into the works here. Instead of, as you say, being the loyal opposition, continuing to build for the next election, actually trying to destroy it, really trying to destroy it, and just not caring about that silly thing called democracy. Robert Parry, you've written that the Tea Party, right, quote, has decided to alter the constitutional framework of the United States to guarantee that the perpetuation of white supremacy and the acceptance of right-wing policies. but again, by throwing this real monkey wrench in, by holding us hostage to this list of demands, unmeetable demands. Are we not witnessing what by law is, in fact, sedition on the part of the Tea Party members of Congress? Could this potentially be picked up and prosecuted under the sedition laws? I mean, isn't sedition defined as trying to block the implementation of a law?
Well, I don't know if we have sedition laws like that. Certainly people have a great deal of freedom in the United States and should to express differences and to try to win over the public to their positions. What's unusual here is that after losing the elections, and only having this toehold of a sort of a phony majority in the House, that this group is now saying not only that they're not really willing to compromise, they're insisting on, even though they lost the election, they're insisting on their policy prescriptions. They're saying I know they had the talking point they've been using about, the Obama won't negotiate, but the fact is that for 6 months, the Senate has been trying to get the House to appoint members to a conference committee that would negotiate the differences between the House and Senate budgets. But the House has refused because they don't want to consider any tax revenue increases. They've said no tax revenue increases, period. And they've insisted on the sequester numbers for the budget. And what happened in July is very interesting, because at that point, House Speaker Boehner went to the Senate Democrats, went to Harry Reid, and said, if you will accept our budget number, our lower budget number, we will just pass a continuing resolution and be done with it. And the Democrats swallowed that concession. They agreed to do it. Then Boehner went back to his caucus, and they apparently said, no, we want to add on a bunch of other things, like blocking the Affordable Care Act and Keystone Pipeline, and they had a whole list of policies they wanted to enforce. And at that point, the Democrats had already accepted the deal, and Boehner reneged on the deal. And we get back to this whole thing of them saying, here's what you have to do, or we're going to shut the government down, which they did. And we may even default on the federal debt, which they are about to, apparently, or getting close to. What you've seen here is a whole... This is not like one side saying, well, we lost the election, so we won't get everything we want. We'll have to maybe compromise, maybe accept some higher taxes on some rich people, close some loopholes or whatever, but we'll maybe get some of what we want in terms of cutting back some programs here or there. This is a case of them saying, no, we're not going to accept any revenue increases. We want these major cuts in programs. We want specific things like the Keystone Pipeline approved. Mm-hmm. We want delays in Obamacare. We want all these things, even though we lost the election. And if you don't give them to us, we're going to basically take down the American economy. And that's what we're headed toward. I mean, the closing down the government, the effects are going to be felt incrementally as we go forward. Already there's been a lot of pain out there.
Mm-hmm.
But the pulling that money out of the economy from people who get various kinds of who do jobs for the federal government, who get contracts with the federal government, etc., that's going to have a ripple effect that's going to have serious consequences for the U.S. economy, which is already sputtering as it was.
Yeah.
And if we go to the debt ceiling thing, despite the Tea Party position that doesn't matter whether or not we actually pay our debts or not,
which is amazing,
that could destabilize the entire world economy, which is already shaky because of the effects of the last time the Republicans were in charge and walked us into the Lehman catastrophe and the Great Recession starting in 2007-2008. So we have here a party that has both lost the elections, has a history of having engaged in some reckless policies that did not do the country any good, and now instead of saying, okay, we're willing to compromise seriously and do some things that the public has expressed a desire to through the elections, we're just going to demand that we get everything we want, and if we don't get it, we're just going to take down the whole system.
And that
kind of a Samson option, if you will, pull the temple down on top of everybody.
And
that isn't that's an extraordinary historical moment. We've certainly seen moments when things have gotten tense in how politics is played in the United States, but we've never seen a major party, as far as I can think, at least not mm-hmm. since the Civil War, behave this way. And basically, it's even unnerved many of the traditional Republican
oh, yes.
backers on Wall Street and in business.
Yeah.
Who see the consequences to their companies. They don't want to be in that temple when it comes down on their heads.
Yeah.
They'd rather keep making money and living very nicely, thanks, rather than seeing the kind of destruction that this Samson option approach is going to take.
And that Samson approach could also be called a tantrum. I mean, that is a classic little kid throwing a tantrum. And the fact that they lost the vote on repealing or defunding the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare, 43 times. It was ruled constitutional by the court. They cannot accept it. I've just never seen anything like that. And to throw this tantrum, it's really a different point in our history. If you just tuned into the Burt Cohen Show, our guest is Robert Perry, who's broke many of the Iran-Contra stories for the Associated Press and Newsweek in 1980. In the 1980s, and has a new book, America's Stolen Narrative, and writes for consortiumnews.com. And the obstructionism, it's something new to me. And you say that, I mean, that was enabled by the gerrymandering and largely but there was some effort at suppression of votes, and they have failed through the legitimate process to achieve their really radical right-wing goals. And as you say, at that point, when they failed to achieve their goals, quote, obstructionism in Congress had to become the rule, not the exception. How does this tactic reflect the overall goal of white male domination, obstructionism becoming the rule, not the exception?
Sorry, what was the question, Bert?
Well, the question is, how does this tactic of going to obstructionism as the way of doing things reflect the overall goal of white male domination?
Well, it's sort of the last card, it seems, that the old white male dominated power structure has in terms of controlling the economy. They're controlling the political system. I mean, basically, what we've seen, and we've seen now, of course, the Supreme Court, which is controlled really by the right now, has five solidly right-wing members, and they've been doing a lot of other things to help out the idea of maintaining this sort of traditional control over our political process. They got rid of many of the restrictions on how much money could be poured into political campaigns
mm-hmm.
through the Citizens United decision, which has opened the floodgates for many of these ultra super rich billionaires to just pour money in to help one candidate or another, even though they claim not to be helping a specific candidate. That's what they do.
Of course,
they gutted the Voting Rights Act to sort of clear the way for. Various states with a history of racial discrimination in voting to make changes without getting federal approval for those changes. And by the way, that ruling flies right into the face of the 15th Amendment, which is very explicit, which was passed in the 1870s and explicitly guarantees the right for people to vote regardless of the color of their skin.
Mm-hmm.
And gives Congress the power to make pass appropriate legislation to protect that right. The five right-wing justices threw that aside and just said, "Well, we don't like that rule." So they're just kind of making. So you have these justices who are, in many cases, making law up as they go.
Yes.
And still, so you're sort of running out of cards to play. They still lost in 2012, despite all these things. Despite the millions and millions of dollars poured in to try to influence the public, despite the efforts to make it by the Republicans to cut down voting hours and take other steps to make it more difficult for minorities to have an equal say in the process.
And
you have all that's happened, and that didn't work, or didn't work well enough anyway. They did keep the House through the gerrymandering.
Right.
But they're running out of cards. And they've been told, you know, after the debacle of last November for the Republicans, they were told, even internally they were told, they're going to have to take steps to make amends with some of these minority groups, that they have to, for instance, support some kind of immigration reform to get the Hispanic vote to not be overwhelmingly Democratic. And what you're seeing here is kind of a, nah, we're not going to do that.
Right.
We're going to go this other way. Instead of trying to change our policies to appeal to these minorities, these darker-skinned people, we're going to just change the whole system. We're going to say, unless you give us what we want, we're going to take it all down.
So they don't.
We're going to destroy everything. And so that's sort of the last card they have to play to maintain this sort of the traditional white supremacy of the country, which I think many of them still very much believe in.
Oh.
They believe that they are superior. This may sound, I know people say that sounds pretty harsh.
Well,
but these are positions that were enunciated by people like William F. Buckley back in the 1950s and by the Wallace people in the 1960s. And all we've seen is that a lot of this has gone sort of underground a bit, because to say these things out in an overt, open way is just no longer socially acceptable. So you have to kind of be a little more subtle, and that's what we're seeing. They're trying to maintain their control and trying to be subtle in their language, or a bit more subtle in their language, but still.
And in doing so,
the point is still there.
And in doing so, it flips the bird, as it were, to democracy itself. It says, no, we don't care what the democratic system, what the constitutional democratic system has produced. We don't care. We want to have white, soon to be minority rule over the rest of the country. And, you know, when I think about, obstructionism against laws, and you mentioned the phrase Jim Crow in your article a couple of times, that, you know, by law, blacks in the South possessed rights equal to that of whites. But the angry Confederates, again, threw a tantrum and had these Jim Crow laws to stop a law from being enforced as a law. And it largely succeeded through extrajudicial and extra legislative measures. And I wonder if these historic successes from this kind of tantrum throwing and results for the white races serve to encourage the right-wing white supremacists now by playing outside the system, by throwing monkey wrenches in. Do they see those successes, however, you know, illegal, as examples that they should follow, do you think, Robert?
Well, you certainly see some of the reprising of those ideas in language, as I say, more subtly. But you're hearing the words like states' rights a lot.
Yes.
The idea of a limited federal government, and frankly, when the framers of the Constitution created what was pretty much an unlimited federal government, they made it what they say in both the preamble and in Article 1, Section 8. Is that the Congress will have the power to promote or provide for the general welfare of the country, as well as the national defense, and the same Section 8 gives the Congress the power to pass laws, appropriate laws to accomplish that. So these are very broad powers that the framers put in, and they were early on attacked, and they were attacked because they were seen as eventual threats to against slavery and against the economic system of the South. So the whole idea of when people talk about limited government or small government or states' rights, this has always been connected to the idea of white supremacy in the United States. That's the history of those words. Now, they seem more neutral. They seem like, oh, yes, of course we need limited government. And in a sense, obviously there are limits in any government, but the limits that were placed in by people like Madison were mostly things like checks and balances within the system. But the idea that that Congress could do ultimately what was necessary to benefit the nation, those powers were very broad. Now, but these words are sort of well chosen. They become part of our political vernacular. But you have to remember where they come from. Why was there this pressure for states' rights? It's not in the Constitution. The people cite amendment the Tenth Amendment, but the Tenth Amendment simply says the powers not given to the Congress and to the federal government by the Constitution will stay with the people and the states. But the point is that the Constitution gave extraordinarily broad powers to the federal government. So it's kind of like a closing the barn door after the horse is gone.
Yeah.
So this history has been, how do you constrain the popular will of the country when it wants to weigh in on things like eliminating slavery or eliminating segregation or passing laws that are seen as beneficial to the broader population, maybe taxing the rich? All those kinds of things are points that these people who attack the federal government are really driving at. They want to limit those intrusions upon the way things have been done. And that is where we are right now. We are at a point where that grouping, using that kind of coded language, wants to maintain this old system where whites dominate, basically white men dominate, although obviously there are women mixed into this too. And the minorities are allowed to express themselves, but not really have power.
Right.
That's the point here, and that's the point that Buckley made back in 57, when he said that Southern whites were correct in taking steps to maintain their control, even when that's not based on their numerical position. In other words, yes, we can allow these little folks, black folks, to express an opinion now and again, but
not really
have, listen to them.
Right, not really have actual power. Can't do that. Just let them.
Right, and now with the African American president,
they can't stand it.
That is, many of us hoped, I think, that we'd be entering a post-racial period.
Huh.
I think instead, what we saw was a last spasm of this kind of racial anger. From the white majority of this country, at least from elements of the white majority of the country.
And I do find it interesting when we talk about such things, the Tea Party people call us racist. So the pattern is, and this is very curious and I guess somewhat effective, if we simply recognize and point out racism, by the fact that people do that, they call us racist. Phenomenal, amazing. And I have to say, I think this in the U.S. Senate, in the past, you never had to get 60 votes again and again and again to pass a bill. It used to be just a simple majority. This is a way the Democrats have a majority in the Senate, but you can have silly people like Ted Cruz and others, require them to get 60 votes. That's a usurpation of democracy. That's trying to destroy democracy. And again, so it appears that, this white man's tantrum. And Robert Perry, you concluded your piece in consortiumnews.com, writing that, quote, the Tea Party induced government shutdown and the extortion demands over the debt ceiling may indeed turn out to be the white man's last tantrum. But this extremist strategy of mayhem and extortion could also be the inauguration of a grim new era of Jim Crow, end quote. What might that new era look like? Can it be stopped? Are Democrats up to the task?
Well, that's always a good question when the Democrats are up to the task for anything.
Clearly.
There has been a history where the Democrats, because they sort of want government to work, are willing to compromise, and they make themselves somewhat vulnerable to these sorts of tactics.
Yeah.
We saw that in 2011 when this first tactic was first brought out by the Tea Party Republicans to default on the debt and tank the economy, have a double dip recession in effect. And President Obama was so frightened of that that he ceded to many of their demands and,
yes.
and put in the so-called sequester cuts. So there's a history that where Republicans often get away with these kinds of bold moves. We saw it in 2000 when the five partisans on the Supreme Court put in George Bush as president, even though Al Gore had won the election. And the Democrats stepped aside for the good of the country and accepted that. Well,
right.
It turned out not to be very good for the country.
Right.
But so there's this history with the Democrats doing that. But I do think they, at least President Obama, has enunciated the position that he recognizes he made a mistake in 2011. He says he won't make it again. So far, the Democrats have recognized that they can't possibly continue to govern in any effective way if they allow these new strategies to take hold. That if every time they try to pass something, it's stopped because the Republicans threaten to tank down, take the economy down and take the government down. That isn't a functional way to have a democracy. But it doesn't mean that it won't work.
Right.
What we're seeing is something quite dramatic and possibly historically significant. A whole new take on our Constitution, really, that a determined minority can get its way simply through a conscious effort of extortion. I think we're tending to understate the dramatic moment we're in. Because we like to say, oh, it's just politics, both sides are at fault,
right, and so forth. Nonsense.
But the reality is this is an effort this is a way for a determined minority to control the U.S. government and get their policies passed or enacted in some way, regardless of the will of the majority. And already there are enough, as you pointed out, things like the states not being representative of the populations. They're based on states, two senators per state, et cetera. And that was put in by the Constitution as part of a compromise to get the smaller states to join. But it certainly does skew the democratic nature of our country and our government from the beginning. But now if you add in there that everything has to be passed with 60 votes, that means a very small number relatively small number of Americans represented by their senators can stop what the vast majority of the Americans may want.
Right.
Something like, say, background checks on gun
right,
show purchases.
Right.
So you have this problem that is already there, but it's now being taken to a new level with this new approach, which is if we don't get our way, that if the right doesn't get its way, then everything is taken down, the economy is sabotaged. People are made to really hurt, and see if you so you have to do what we want.
Absolutely amazing, and let's hope it's, as you say, the white man's last tantrum. I mean, it's clearly a tantrum. I don't know if it's going to be the last. I sure hope so. It's always great to talk with you, Robert Parry, knowing history and how much it counts. Follow his stuff at consortiumnews.com. Great stuff. Very, very informative consistently. And the title of this particular article is The White Man's Last Tantrum. We will see. It's pretty scary. We'll see if some of the old South may win again. Thanks again for being with us, Robert Parry.
Thank you, Bert.
All right.
Worse than death before you. Two arms, two arms, two arms in Dixie. Blow all the beacon fires are lighted. Let all hearts be now united. Two arms, two arms, two arms in Dixie. Advance the flag of Dixie. Hoorah, hoorah. For Dixie's land we take our stand and live or die for Dixie. To arms, to arms, and conquer peace for Dixie. To arms, and conquer peace for Dixie. Oh, hear the northern thunders mutter, northern flags and south winds flutter. To arms, to arms, to arms in Dixie. Send them back your fierce defiance, stamp upon the cursed alliance. To arms, to arms, to arms in Dixie. Advance the flag of Dixie, hoorah, hoorah. For Dixie's land we take our stand, and live or die for Dixie. To arms, and conquer peace for Dixie. To arms, and conquer peace for Dixie. Fear no danger, shun no labor, lift up rifle, pike, and saber. To arms, to arms, to arms in Dixie. Shoulder pressing close to shoulder, let the odds make each heart bolder. To arms, to arms, to arms in Dixie. Advance the flag of Dixie, hoorah, hoorah. For Dixie's land we take our stand, and live or die for Dixie. To arms, and conquer peace for Dixie. To arms, and conquer peace for Dixie. Stand, deliver, die, Dixie.